From New England Public Radio in Springfield, Massachusetts, this is NEPR News Now. Stories you really should not miss. Thanks for spending a little bit of your summer with us. I'm Sam Hudzik, the news director at New England Public Radio. On the show today, a vault in Massachusetts holds the seeds of rare plants native to New England. This is serious business.
So you lose a plant, you lose everything that depends upon it. And if you lose enough plants, you lose many of the important services that they provide to us as humans.
Then another installment of our energy reporting project, The Big Switch. Some northern New Englanders aren't so happy power-hungry Massachusetts wants to essentially run a giant extension cord through their states.
There is a very large, committed activist base that is mobilized against this project.
And how about the eclipse? Some college students in Connecticut have a way to get a really good view of it using a camera and a balloon.
And it'll get eventually to an altitude that will cause it to burst.
Hopefully it bursts after the eclipse. We'll have more on that in a bit. But first, I want to start off with an interview that gets to the heart of this week that I think we can agree has been disturbing. Chicopee, Massachusetts author Crystal Center teamed up with her mother, illustrator Janice Treese Center, on a new kids' book. AJ and the Magic Kite is a picture book about the contributions of African-American inventors. In the story, a black boy is bullied by classmates who call African-Americans worthless. Crystal Center tells New England Public Radio's Karen Brown the incident was based on something that happened to her own son in kindergarten.
He was in a Catholic school in Chicopee, and he was being teased because he was the only black boy in the school, only brown boy in the school, really. And so I thought about ways that I could empower him. So I wrote the story way back when. So he's 24 now, so I wrote it 19 years ago. And about a year ago, I started hearing about another friend of mine whose son was being bullied as well. And I said, yeah, I think that might be a good time to publish this book. And because I wanted to empower children that were different and to show, especially children of color, how the world would be without our contributions.
How did you choose the inventions that you feature in this book? So we have sort of a magical boy named Jerome, yeah, who takes the main character, AJ, around in a magic kite. And from above, he sees what the world would be without the inventions that were made by African Americans. And so we have an elevator, safety device, a traffic light, a dustpan, a kitchen table, a doorknob. How did you choose those items?
I was thinking about what items would exist in a regular home. So if you walked into a home, what would be some of the things that if they were missing, it would be obvious? And so something like a kitchen table, if someone is sitting on the floor eating their dinner instead of at a table or sitting on a chair, that will be noticeable. And if you go to reach for a doorknob and it's not there, that will be noticeable. And so some of the other things, which is I thought that they were very impactful, like the stoplight. I thought, like, without that, we would, you know, we'd be I'm sure someone else would have invented it later, maybe. But we would be crashing into each other. And so I thought that was a very funny, like, the way that my mother drew that picture, I liked how she had them kind of like one of the characters in the street. His arms are raised like he's really mad because, you know, because the cars hit each other.
Now, the message in this book is very upbeat, and it's fairly simple. It's bringing up the point that African Americans have had huge impact on the world through inventions. But this week, the news has been really dark.
Yes.
You know, we've had the white supremacists in Charlottesville. We have at least one image of a black man being publicly bludgeoned.
Yes.
So how can you address that level of hatred in the world, you know, for children in a way that they can understand without being overly scared or discouraged? Can you do that with children's literature?
I think you can, and I think that you have to be honest with your children. I don't think you should scare your children, but I think that you should always let them know that there will be people who won't like you no matter what you do. And I think that what happened this week was scary for all of us, but it also just kind of pointed to just how the world is today. And I honestly think that this will spark more children's books about this type of topic. I hope it will anyway, because I think it is it's an opportunity for parents to teach their children how to love themselves, how to love each other. And I think children learn this. I mean, they don't grow up hating each other. They learn it from somebody. And so I think it's up to us as parents to be the example of loving everybody equally. But also be honest, I think there's some parents that kind of paint this picture perfect world, and then children will see these images on the news of people being run over, you know, by a car. Like, one image that stuck out to me was when the car plowed through the people, and there's an African American young man that's up in the air. He's like up off the ground. And then you see another image of the car backing up, and you see his shoe in the bumper of the car. Children are going to see that. They're going to see those images because it's in between cartoons. You know what I mean? But just be honest. Just be honest and as open as you can be without scaring them, which is it's a very thin line, I know.
Crystal Center's new picture book for young children is AJ and the Magic Kite. That interview is part of our annual Back to School book series. You can find more selections from this series at NEPR.net. Crystal Center's message there ties in directly with a commentary we aired recently. Coincidentally, it's also from a children's book author, Grace Lynn. A few years ago, Lynn joined the diversity committee of her child's preschool when one of the members asked whether race really needed to be addressed with young children. Lynn instantly knew her answer.
When I was a child, the way adults dealt with race in my community was by not talking about it. I remember in fifth grade, after I answered a question correctly, a boy burst in saying, "She just knows that because she's trying," only to be cut off by our teacher. She shook her head at him, then continued on with the lesson as if nothing had happened. But the message was clear. We were to never mention my race. I realize now that silencing my classmate was my teacher's way of trying to create racially blind kids, kids who don't see color. But as the only Asian in a classroom of white faces, I did not feel colorless. I felt as if I had this shameful secret that everyone knew but didn't talk about. The imposed silence just made me feel something was wrong with me. And attempting to teach color blindness apparently didn't help at least one of my fellow students either. Thanks to social media, I recently found myself reading an article from my hometown newspaper. A refugee resettlement center's budget had been cut, making it likely no new refugees would be coming to town. From the comments which followed, it was clear many people were pleased by this. One comment, however, upset me more than the others. The name of the person who wrote it was familiar. He was one of my fifth grade classmates. That discovery was one reason I decided to become chair of that diversity committee. I convinced the committee to develop at our school something we're calling the Community Book Stop, a small library that contains books featuring characters of color. Inside each book, we've taped discussion suggestion sheets to help foster conversation between parents and their kids. We've also included blank paper so parents can share their thoughts to help the next reader. It's a simple idea, but one I hope will bring the topic of race into the home and beyond. And while I know that seems like a small action considering what's needed in the world, I also know it's from seeds that everything begins. If we're lucky, this project will encourage a culture in which we can acknowledge our differences and talk about our problems. Maybe, by doing so, we'll even begin to fix them.
Grace Lynn is the author and illustrator of more than a dozen children's books. She lives in Florence, Massachusetts. Biologists worldwide are saving seeds from crops and from other plants important to the ecosystem. In New England, 22% of the region's native plants are considered rare. Some of them are on the federal list of endangered species. Seed banking is one attempt to stop them from disappearing altogether. As New England Public Radio's Jill Kaufman reports, collectors are stepping up their pace.
There is a seed ark in Framingham, Massachusetts, at Garden in the Woods, a place as beautiful as its name. Bill Brumback, conservation director at the New England Wildflower Society, unlocks the door to the cinder block building that houses the ark, or vault. It looks exactly like the extra freezer you might keep in your garage, except for what's inside. Brumback raises the lid.
Okay, there are only rare seeds in this vault.
About a million rare seeds in sealed foil packets. Handwritten labels note the species name, where and when the seeds were gathered, and if the electricity goes out.
Seeds in a freezer is not like meat that's going to spoil. You're talking about things that may have a shelf life, if you will, of hundreds of years.
Some seeds may lose their viability, and scientists will be testing for that over time. For something so vital, the setup and security is rather unremarkable. It's not Fort Knox. It's not even Fort Collins in Colorado, where seeds for the National Apple Collection live. What is remarkable is that Brumback has been collecting the seeds from rare native plants since 1982.
Well, it was a good idea back then, and that was before climate change became more notorious.
Other threats to plant life have been around a long time. Deforestation, reforestation, dammed up rivers, growing cities and suburbs, even something as unassuming as a public trail. About 2,400 plants are considered native New Englanders, like Jess's milk vetch.
She was found in three places in the world, all along a 16-mile stretch of the Connecticut River in New Hampshire and Vermont.
Brumback is also worried about Castilleja.
It's a paintbrush, Indian paintbrush, and it's now only found in Connecticut. It was much, much wider than that.
Ecologists occasionally break into the vault and use seeds to reintroduce plants to their natural habitat. Brumback's big goal is to fill the ark with seeds from approximately 300 rare native species by 2020. That's thousands of seeds per species from multiple locations. At last count, with the help of hundreds of trained volunteers, a lot of private and some public money, they were about halfway there. Brumback says he needs another freezer. More seeds are coming.
I'm Elizabeth Farnsworth, and I'm senior research ecologist with New England Wildflower Society. And I am curating our collections of seed from rare plant populations.
Farnsworth is based in Western Massachusetts. The Wildflower Society has a plant farm and its seed dehydration equipment in Wheatley. Farnsworth is looking at GoBotany, a plant identification website. She shows me a picture of a rare glaucescent sedge.
And here are the seeds that we're going to collect, or the fruits, I should say, that have the seeds inside them.
And is it at that stage right now?
We certainly hope so.
To me, that rare sedge looks like a clump of grass. But Farnsworth says, once I see it in the wild, I'll never not see it again. That is, if we can find it. And it's a species she's rather fond of.
Back in 2001, it was still known as Carex flaccosperma, var glaucodia.
Farnsworth gets serious when she tells me, I can't tell you where we're going. Scientists are very protective of rare plants. They don't want civilian Johnny Appleseeds over-collecting and planting in the wrong spots.
All right, shall we start walking?
It's raining. It's a beautiful walk. And we walk and walk and double back. We go off trail, up a steep incline.
As we head a little bit deeper into the forest, I expect to see actually much of these herbaceous plants sort of drop out. We'll be looking for these guys.
Fingers crossed, Farnsworth says as she walks on.
And I'm looking for that characteristic sort of blue-greenish color.
There's a little opening in the tree cover, and Farnsworth is sure this is where she last found the sedge.
I will say I'm a bit puzzled. Just may not be my lucky day here.
In the next few minutes, she sees several other varieties, but not the rare glaucescent. Farnsworth stops, and she picks something up and looks at it for a while with the magnifying lens she wears around her neck.
I believe it is our glaucescent sedge, even though it doesn't look particularly glaucous in the pouring rain. They're so past at this point, they're actually very over-mature, shall we say. So I may have gotten out here just a little too late. But at least we know that there's still one or two of these guys. A little clump over there.
While the survival of humankind doesn't depend on finding this one rare sedge today, Farnsworth says the entire ecosystem is at risk.
So you lose a plant, you lose everything that depends upon it. And if you lose enough plants, you lose many of the important services that they provide to us as humans.
Like oxygen and medicine and, of course, food. We're hungry, and Farnsworth happens to find some tiny blueberries on a bush right near where she found the sedge. The seed arc may never be fully needed, but Farnsworth says the climate science is irrefutable. It could make an ecologist, among others, not want to get out of bed in the morning. Though, she says you do see plants come back from the brink. Like Henry David Thoreau before her, Elizabeth Farnsworth has faith in a seed. For New England Public Radio, I'm Jill Kaufman.
Let's stay on the general topic of things having to do with climate change. A plan by Massachusetts to inject more renewable energy into its electricity mix could reshape the entire region's energy landscape. Dozens of developers are competing to offer Massachusetts the best price for long-term contracts to supply clean energy to hundreds of thousands of homes. But many of the projects also face another challenge, convincing residents of northern New England it's in their interest to host the Bay State's Extension Cord. From the New England News Collaborative, Fred Bever takes a look at the stakes.
For all the attention renewable power gets, it still provides only about 10% of New England's electrical energy. The region's recent successes in reducing emissions of greenhouse gases have come to the greatest degree from the rise of relatively clean-burning natural gas as the dominant power source.
To me, that's the story in New England.
Sarah Burns is CEO of Central Maine Power, Maine's largest utility. She says big, long-term renewable energy contracts being sought by Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker could mark a tipping point.
Actually, I think that's what Charlie Baker's trying to do here. Make bigger plays to make a bigger difference on this.
Burns is a close follower of Baker's plan because it's about more than just windmills, dams, and big solar farms. It's about the high-voltage transmission lines her company specializes in, the kind needed to transport bulk electricity from remote locations to market. CMP is one of a half dozen companies bidding to build transmission lines 100 miles long and more, running from or through the three northern New England states to link up to Massachusetts. Billions of dollars are at stake, and each of the bidders is trying to highlight selling points, even as they fend off challenges from competitors and critics.
There is a very large, committed activist base that is mobilized against this project.
Sam Evans Brown hosts New Hampshire Public Radio's Outside In podcast, and for 7 years he's watched debate over a transmission proposal in his state called Northern Pass. It would carry electricity from Hydro-Québec's massive dam system in Canada to Massachusetts, part of it buried under the White Mountains. Evans Brown says opponents want to know why their scenery should become the pass-through for Massachusetts' electricity needs.
People who have businesses that would be impacted by the construction and who believe that their business depends on tourists coming up to visit. You know, there's a very famous pancake parlor that the owner came and gave impassioned testimony.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Kathy Aldrich Cote.
She is co-owner of that pancake house at a recent state hearing on the project.
It will be devastational for us. Tourists will avoid the area and find other destinations to visit. They may not return for many years, if at all.
Just this year, an alternative emerged in New Hampshire called the Granite State Power Link. In contrast to several proposals that depend on existing Hydro-Québec facilities, this one would carry power from new wind and new solar energy plants. Project Director Joseph Rossignoli says that means bigger reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, as called for by Massachusetts climate policies.
And that's significant because contracting with resources that are not in service yet and would only go into service to the extent that they won the bid, that really provides meaningful progress towards the Global Warming Solution Act goals.
There'll be different strategies that will be employed.
Kerrick Johnson is an executive at the Vermont Electric Power Company, which runs part of that state's grid. Velco is backing a Vermont project called the TDI Clean Power Link. It would sluice electricity to Massachusetts from Hydro-Québec via cable below Lake Champlain. Johnson says TDI's strategy is working in Vermont. Few above-ground lines to draw opposition and a helpful TDI agreement to subsidize transmission bills for Vermonters. And Johnson says no matter who wins or what eventual configuration is chosen, the Massachusetts procurement is just a curtain raiser for renewable efforts to come.
You know, each of the six New England states are notoriously and gloriously independent, and the process isn't finished. We'll see how it plays out.
The contract winners are expected to be announced in January. Meantime, another big Charlie Baker play is coming up. Long-term energy contracts relying almost exclusively on offshore wind turbines, which could be the next big thing for renewable power in the Northeast. It's still a relatively costly technology, but here's one advantage. You can build ocean-based windmills pretty close to the demand centers and avoid all those long transmission lines. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Fred Bever in Portland, Maine.
That story is part of the energy reporting project, The Big Switch. Okay, let's wrap up with a light story about the lack of light. Next week, students and professors from two Connecticut universities will launch a high-altitude weather balloon to capture video of the total solar eclipse. WNPR's David DeRoche reports.
Here we go.
That sound you're hearing is helium racing through a huge latex balloon. Students from the universities of Hartford and Bridgeport are preparing to launch it 35,000 feet into a clear blue sky.
and it'll get eventually to an altitude that will cause it to burst.
That's John Ferreira, a professor at U of H. But on the way up, the camera will be taking video. Then, at 35,000 feet, a device releases a parachute, and the camera slowly makes its way back to solid ground. The balloon sails off higher and higher until it explodes into tiny pieces.
I think the coolest thing is that it's going to provide video of the full eclipse to everybody everywhere.
Cater Orico is also a professor at U of H.
And it should be live, which is awesome. And it's all student collaborations across the country. Every team is made up of students, college students from the entire country.
Today, the Connecticut team is going through a dry run because on the day of the eclipse, there won't be much room for error. That's because the eclipse will only be full for a few minutes. This is supposed to be a learning experience for the students who are doing most of the work. So even though things didn't go perfectly, they now know exactly where to double check on the big day. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm David DeRoche in Hartford.
All right, thanks so much for listening to NEPR News Now. This podcast is produced by New England Public Radio, a listener-supported public media company that brings you news and music and NEPR.net. Check it out, and while you're there, you can make a contribution to New England Public Radio. Click the orange Donate button at the top of the screen. Until next time.